Okay, so let's get back to what we are doing. Is this, should I just reduce that backlighting a little bit more, probably? Okay. So first thing, you should remove the midterms away from you. I mean, I sent the mail before so that if there is any celebration or whatever sorrow, you should have it before you come to the class so that we can continue with life here. Anyway, and if you have questions on the grading, you know, you can always talk to me afterwards. I'll send the answers. Any questions? Not on the specific marks that you got, but anything else? Okay. So I am going to go back to the text categorization, which we are discussing last time. And so if you remember, we in some sense, we went in some clustering into classification and then looked at directly using distance-based methods, centroidal method, as well as the k-nearest neighbor method. Okay. One thing we noticed actually is the centroidal method has some problems. For example, it's not very good at handling non-spherical clusters. That's not a problem for nearest neighbor method. In fact, it was pretty good at handling, you know, non-spherical clusters. So in some sense, actually, so here are, and then we also talked about the more general spectrum of methods for learning patterns from the data, where, you know, we are mostly interested in text data, but we started looking at something different from text data, in this case, the restaurant data, okay? And basically, the learning problem is the same. You know, the specifics will change. Some specifics will change because of the fact that you're interested in text. But the issue is when you learn patterns from the, when you see patterns in the training data, you might want to write this down in some representation. And the representation in which you write down your patterns is your bias. Okay. So basically, you could be writing the patterns as association rules, you can write them as decision trees, you can write them as support vector machines, you can write them as neural networks, you can write them as Bayes networks, so you learn data, learn Bayes networks from the data directly. Okay, of course, now the question is, within this, okay, they're all here, and then I suddenly put k-nearest neighbors here, which was from the last time around, okay. One interesting point before I go forward, in fact, the point I left last time was among these different types of internal representations, different types of biases will be good for different kinds of learning techniques. In particular, I was mentioning that if whether or not you belong to a certain class depends on either presence or absence of just a few features. There's some critical features, and based on those critical features, I can tell you whether you belong to the class or not. Okay, in those cases, you would actually do very well with decision tree sorts of methods, also association rule sorts of methods, because you're sort of looking for the silver bullet that explains the class. Okay, now if you're interested in something like predicting whether or not a mail is spam mail, now, so you're looking for some silver bullet method. You know, again, as you're looking at this, in the case of restaurant data, the attributes are things like alternatives, bar, and whether it's a Friday, etc., etc. If you're looking at text data, the attributes are the words themselves. In fact, we'll look at it in a minute, but think of in the back of your head that whenever we're considering text data, the attributes would be words. And you can think of Boolean attributes, that means is the word present or not present, or multi-value attributes, which tell you how many times is that word present. Okay? So the question then is, if I'm trying to use decision trees to decide whether or not something is a spam mail, I should be looking for some small subset of words that are the smoking gun for making something into a spam mail. Okay, there are such words. For example, as we kept talking about, the Nigerian millions is a word, and if you have Nigerian millions in your mail, it's probably a spam mail. And similarly, Viagra is probably a spam mail. But there are also a large number of spam mails which don't have those words, and there is no simple way of explaining that this single word made it into spam. Okay, in those cases, if you're trying to look at your pattern in terms of decision trees, then what would happen is you will ask way too many questions on each of the words. Is this word present? And if it is present these many times, then is this word present? If it is present these many times, then is this word present? And if by the time you ask all these questions, the decision tree would be as long as the number of words, as deep as the number of words in the document. Now, the problem with that essentially is that the number of examples you would need to learn the entire decision tree structure would be very large. Okay? There's nothing wrong with decision trees except, you know, in something like spam mail or class detection for text documents, they are not as useful. And there are some other ones, for example, the Bayes network method, for example, would be quite good, okay, in terms of deciding whether or not something is a spam mail, because there you don't expect that there is a single attribute which has some magic value. Rather, that if this is a question of just you do some number of good things, you have some number of good words, some number of bad words. At some point of time, your score of having spammy words has increased enough that I'll call you a spam mail. Do you see what I'm saying? So it is an interesting thing, actually. If you ask in those kinds of scenarios, one of the issues in classification is classification is connected also to recommendation systems, which we'll be looking at a little later. So if I tell you that this mail is spam mail, then you might want to know what's your explanation. Why do you think it's a spam mail? Okay, why aren't you not letting me read this? Of course, you can read this and figure out that, yes, it's a spam mail. But suppose I'm trying to give you a small explanation as to why this is a spam mail. If I learned the spamness of the mail using a decision tree, I can just tell you it's because it has the following word, Viagra, and it has this following word, something else. Whereas if I learned this using these kinds of techniques, naive-based classifier or something, it's like saying there are some number of bad words, some number of good words, and that the total has exceeded certain level of threshold, and so it's a spam mail. It's a pretty bad explanation. Do you see what I'm saying? So these techniques cannot explain to you why the label has been given. Okay, so for those cases where you need explanations, that is because people in the, you know, the humans in the loop want an explanation before they take your classification, then you need to find explainable methods, okay? But in this case, we'll assume that nobody requires like an actual explanation for spam mail, okay? So there's a difference in the kind of internal representations you're trying to learn, the way they're looking for the patterns in the data, and whether or not the particular label you're trying to learn can be better done in this versus that. Yes.
As we're telling you the IBM text, maybe you can interpret whatever is being said in this format and then probably extend it.
That's different story. I mean, that's possibly true, but I mean that's outside of the class because not everybody was in that talk. You're right, but you know I will not get into that. Okay. So now one other thing, of course, is. So these all have a kind of an approach, which is they're looking for patterns in the data and representing those patterns. Now, if you look at something like k-nearest neighbors, which was our best method until now, it was pretty good. Okay? Now, it doesn't fall in this category. So k-nearest neighbors, so the most of the methods other than the k-nearest neighbors there take training data. Convert it into a learned representation and then use the learned representation to predict classes. Okay? Whereas in the case of k-nearest neighbor, there is no learned representation. The training data itself is the learned representation. Right? And when you get a test data, you basically look at how close is it to various points in the, so basically look at the test data and look at the neighborhood of it and see how many of the its neighbors have one class versus other class. Okay, so the idea, so in some sense, in this case, in this picture, everything else is of one type. All of them look for patterns in the data, except this except this. So actually think about centroidal distance approach. What do you think of centroid method? Remember that we talked about, so KNN basically takes the entire training data. Okay, what about the centroidal method? It only remembers the centroids of the training data. It doesn't remember the entire training data. So it is remembering a learned representation. As simple as it might look to you, it's a learned representation. The nice thing about learned representations are that you could, in some sense, learning, actually in an interesting way of looking at learning is a compression technique. In fact, most techniques that can compress data are also good learning techniques. Okay? So what you really did was, in learning the learned representation, you basically are compressing the data into some, you know, patterns that are found in this data. And you can use just that to predict the test cases. Whereas KNN does not do any compression. So just to be able to do learning, you don't always have to do compression. But many of these other techniques do a kind of a compression, because after learning, you can throw away the training data and just keep the learned representation. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so the difference between these two kinds of things are basically what are called parametric versus non-parametric learners. Okay? The idea in the case of parametric learners, everything other than KNN that you have seen till now is a parametric learner. Okay. In the case of parametric learner, the learned representation, the size of the learned representation is separately decided. It has nothing to do with the amount of training data you have. It's not proportional to the amount of training data. Okay. One classic example of learning class differences in, let's say, binary class specification is, suppose these are all pluses, that means this is all, you know, and these are all minuses. Right? So what I could do, for example, is I could look for a line that separates the data. Okay? And you know, anything above this line is considered negative, anything below this line is considered positive. Okay? The interesting thing about this method is how much ever data I give, the description of this line is y equal to mx plus c. So all I have are the parameters m and c. I will get m and c more accurately if I have more data. But the learned representation is not increasing because of the amount of training data I have. Okay? So now, of course, you can increase the learned representation here too. So for example, if I'm looking for polynomials of degree 1, then I'm looking for lines. Suppose I say somebody else is looking for polynomials of degree up to 100, then they will need 100 coefficients for the polynomial. Okay? And they would be able to draw pretty, you know, fancy lines separating these. They could say, so for example, in this particular case, if there had been a few negatives on this side and there's a few positives on this side, you would probably still have put the red line there. And you'll say the rest is noise. Whereas if I give you a more effective learner which actually learns, you know, 100 parameters based polynomial, then you would actually be able to learn something like this. That's my decision surface now. Anything above the polynomial is positive, and anything below the polynomial is negative. Okay, so in this case, I have more parameters, except again, these parameters don't depend on the data. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so the number of parameters you put in your learner is independent of the size of the training data. In that case, you call them parametric learners. Most learners are parametric learners. Okay, the opposite is the non-parametric learners, which is like KNN is the best case you have, actually, that you have seen here, where you just keep the entire data around with you. Okay, and so you don't compress the data at all, you don't, and the size of the learned representation is directly proportional to the size of the training data. So in some sense, actually, you would do more work during classification time if you have more neighbors, if you have more points, because then you have to look at closed points within all these points. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind. We are now going sort of from non-parametric method, which is KNN, to a parametric method, which is a Bayes network, naive Bayes network, okay, where we decide upfront how many parameters we are going to learn. And the thing to remember is you can learn, you know, one of the things we'll see is you could do Bayes networks making humongous assumptions, which is what naive Bayes networks do. That will reduce the number of parameters you need to learn. Or you can make fewer assumptions about the correlations between the data, and then you will learn more parameters. But these assumptions are made independent of how much data you got to train. Okay, that's the difference. Okay, now one more thing I want to say, as long as we're here, about KNN is KNN, as nice as it sounds, it has its own problems. In fact, it's kind of connected to the high-dimensional apples. Remember, we talked about high-dimensional apples, which are all peel and no core, and it didn't look like, other than having a cute, you know, mental picture, it didn't look like it had any practical implication. But suppose you are considering this. So suppose you're considering, 10 nearest neighbors for a point in a hypercube which has 1 million points. But this hypercube, the number of dimensions of the hypercube is going from 0 to 25 to 50 to 100 to 200 and so on. When you do this, you know, if the cube becomes high dimensional or the sphere becomes high dimensional, what's happening is everybody goes far away in the hypercube or hypersphere. So what happens in this case is the percentage, the proportion of the points that are on the exterior of the shell just keeps going close to 100%. So there are no neighbors. Everybody is equidistant from you, and they're kind of running away from you, right? So because of that, you know, this curse of dimensionality that we have talked about before, curse of high dimensionality, is going to wind up affecting the ability of KNN to do a good job. Okay, so you have to reduce the dimensions. Of course, you might reduce the dimensions by first looking at the data and doing something like LSI, reduce the dimensions, and then do KNN. Then that'll be fine. Otherwise, you are likely to, for example, in this case, suppose this one actually turns out to be a regression problem, but suppose there are like some negatives this side, some positives that side. Then KNN is likely to find a highly irregular separating surface. And the problem with the highly irregular separating surfaces is that they very much depend upon the data. If you just throw one more point, the surface changes again. That's what's called overfitting. That means you are learning the noise in the data rather than learning the pattern in the data. Okay? So that's the other problem with KNN. Even though it's good, if you want to use KNN, then you want to reduce its dimensionality. Okay? Now, high dimensionality is not a problem for this guy because there are only 1, 2, 3, 4, like, I think 10 dimensions for the restaurant case. Okay, so 10 dimensions is pretty good. 10 dimensions is somewhere here. Okay, but for the text documents, the number of dimensions is going to be more like thousands and millions, thousands and tens of thousands, because the number of different words you have. Okay, so that's the other point about nearest neighbors. So now I'm going to, so in some sense we understood one good non-parametric method. Now we're going to understand one good parametric method. Okay, there are many, many parametric methods, but we'll learn one of them. So, and again, as I said, in terms of looking for parametric methods, or any methods in general, the one point we have to realize, that these two points we have to realize. One is representations of text are high dimensional, very high dimensional, so KNN is not really going to be all that good. So anything that's not, you know, good at dealing with high dimensional data is probably not a good approach. Okay. The second thing is, for many text categorization tasks, there are many irrelevant and many relevant features. There is typically no silver bullet saying if you have this magic word, then your class is this. If you have this small subset of magic words, then your class is this. Those are the ones that can be easily explained. Okay, but those are also don't actually happen in most text documents. Okay, and so you need representations such as naive Bayes, and KNN works too, but KNN doesn't work with respect to the number of dimensions. Okay, naive Bayes, neural networks, these all will work. Okay, so we will look at compared to something like decision tree or association rule mining. Okay, so we'll look at and by the way, the other thing that does work also is the separating planes. So you can learn a plane that separates the data, okay? And that's what actually is another good approach, which I'm not going to discuss here, but that's support vector machines, okay? So the difference between just finding a line and finding a support vector machine is very simple. I mean, at least intuitively. So basically, okay, suppose you have something like this, then if you're just finding a line that is separating, then pretty much any line is as good as any other line. So this is considered a good line, so is this, so is this. Any of them are separating the concepts. Support vector machines basically want to find the line that's somehow the best among these lines. Now the question, of course, then is what is the best? You essentially look for the line that is sort of the equidistant from the closest positive and closest negative point. Okay, so something like there, this is the distance from the closest positive point, this is the distance from the closest negative point. So you can think of these two guys, these two are vectors. Remember, they are decision points, these are data points, and they are vectors, right? And these vectors are holding up the plane, and those are called the support vectors in this case. Okay, so you can learn that sort of a, you know, classification, support vector machines, where essentially you are learning in a high dimensional, I mean, a plane which separates the positives and negatives, and that will also have this advantage, you know, the same advantage that the that we are talking about here, which is multiple features can be relevant in deciding your class. Okay. Anyway, so I'm going to mostly focus on naive Bayes classifiers because they're actually quite useful, and people have used it in, I mean, it's like the first idea you will try if you're doing text classification. Okay? First idea you'll try if you're doing, yes?
What about
neural networks? Basically, the problem with them is they take forever to train. So the question is, how much time do you take to go from the training data to learn representation? That's called the learning time. Okay? A fast learner basically will take very, fast learner can be thought of in two different ways. One is, how many examples does it need before it reaches 100% accuracy? And secondly, how much time does it take to process these examples to learn the internal representation? Do you see what I'm saying? So neural networks typically tend to take a lot more time to train. Okay? And it's the same thing for Bayes networks. You know, instead of naive Bayes networks, if you consider full Bayes networks, they will take more time. Okay? And similarly, instead of lines, if you are looking for polynomials that separate data, you will take more time. So that's like training time will be higher. Okay. Again, the game that I'm playing here is rather than just completely subroutine into a different course. You know, last week it was clustering course. Now I can do classification course. I'm just trying to find one idea which would be quite useful for text data, and that also sort of makes you think of, you know, some of the important issues. Okay. Okay. And in fact, you know, it's not just one of the ideas. It is in fact the idea. I remember one time. Somebody asked Peter Narvig, who was at that time the head of the research division at Google, but he's a natural language guy, and as to what machine learning techniques do they use. And this was a few years back, and he said naive-Bayes classification, that's it. And any undergrad student can understand naive-Bayes classification completely. Okay, and it was like a good golden mean, you know, that's something that actually made sense, you know, for most of the cases. It's not that the other ideas are not better, it's just that this is a first thing that you will try most of the time. So we'll try to understand that. Okay, and so here basically you are looking at some sort of a probabilistic, so naive-Bayes classification is a probabilistic method where in some sense the learned representation is the following. So you have this assumption. Your assumption is that, remember that, you know, for now we'll just assume we are looking at binary classes, you know, but generally you can look at n-ary classes. There can be n different classes, and each example is one of these belongs to one of these n different classes, and you have been given some training data and their labels saying which class they belong to, and then you're given test data, okay, and you have to figure out what the label for the test data is. Okay, right? So the assumption this learned representation makes, you know, every representation makes some assumption. Here this one is, there's a bunch of 20 questions that you can ask to figure out, you know, what is the label of a point. Here you are assuming there is, you know, if, you know, certain values or certain attributes have certain values, then the class would be something, you know, will be given with some confidence. Okay. Here the assumption is that you assume that classes cause features. So this is your mental, you know, outlook. So you think that the way the examples are generated, both the training and test examples, if somebody picks a class, they'll say, okay, spam mail. And then if they believe that they're generating spam mail, then they will have a certain probability that word one will occur, word two will occur, word three will occur. Then they will essentially, those are all the, you know, attributes for you. If on the other hand, you are looking at the restaurant scenario, if I would decide upfront that, okay, I'm going to generate a won't wait example, that means, you know, this example would correspond to the person not waiting for a table, then I would try to learn a network which sort of tells me if you are not going to wait, then the probability that the wait time is less than 10 is this much, probability that it's greater than 15 is this much, and so on. It is these probabilities that I'm trying to learn from the data. Okay, now what I wrote here, this is the simplest form of probabilistic relationship between classes and the attributes. Okay, the most general one could be that I have a class C, which then generates, it decides something else, like some syndrome, which will then generate certain attributes here and some other syndrome, some other attributes. So basically, you don't have to have a single label. Okay? But we are assuming a naive base. The naive part of the naive base is that you're assuming classes directly cause the attributes. There is no intermediary. Classes directly cause the attributes. And furthermore, again, this is one of the situations, I mean, if I can ask this question, how many of you know Bayes network? one. Okay, that one person would probably understand this at a deeper level than the rest of you. But you need to understand to some extent Bayes networks to understand Naive-Bayes classifier. But I'm trying to get that, you know, some of that background to you here. To specify this network, what I will need to do, for now let's assume all of these are Boolean attributes. Okay, so first to provide this representation, I need to provide here the prior probability of class. If it's a Boolean class, then what's the probability that the class is going to be positive? What's the probability that class is going to be negative? And then for each of these guys, I need to provide probability that A1 given C. That is, if C is positive, what's the probability that A1 will be true? If C is negative, what's the probability that A1 would be true? Those are the probabilities I need. Once I give that probabilities, then I essentially have this entire network in front of me. Okay, then what I can do essentially is in the training cases, I have both the class information and the attribute value information. So I use them to learn the parameters for the network. In this case, the parameters for the network are these probabilities. Okay? When the test examples are given, I only have the attributes, not the class. So in essence, I do inference on this network using Bayes rule. Okay? And then figure out if these variables have these values, these attributes have these values, what is the probability that class is positive? What's the probability that the class is negative? And whichever probability is higher, you will say that is the class I am going to stick to. So in essence, you're doing full probabilistic reasoning here. When you give a test data, then you actually get what's called a posterior distribution on the class. Knowing this evidence, I believe that the class being positive is, you know, previously let's say class being positive is 0.5 and class being negative is 0.5. Then having seen the evidence, my new posterior distribution might be class being positive is 0.7, class being negative is 0.3. Okay? Right? So that is basically what I'm going to do in the testing case. Okay? So in the learning, I'm learning the network, parameters for the network. In the inference, I'm using the network to compute the posterior on the class, given the values of the attributes. Okay, if you are completely surprised at things like probabilities and posteriors, you just have to go back and look at some elementary probability theory. Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to do this now. You know, here. So my problem, of course, is given some example E, I want to classify into one of these classes C1 to CN. I'm looking at the more general case. Okay, so let's assume that example E has k attributes, A1 to AK, and they have some values. Each attribute can take, let's say, some D values. If it's a Boolean attribute, it takes true or false values. Colin, can you get up and wash your face and come back? Thank you. So you have k attributes. You have k attributes, and they could be Boolean, or they could actually have, you know, some domain value, right? So now, what I'm trying to do is, given this example whose attribute values are known, I want to compute this probability. What's the class probability given the attribute values? That's what I'm trying to do. Okay. Now, Bayes classification is assign example E to the class CI that maximizes this probability. So whichever class has the highest probability, that's the one you'll take. Okay? So next thing basically is I will use Bayes network, Bayes rule. How many of you know Bayes rule? Okay, if the rest of you should be very worried. Okay, I mean Bayes rule is obviously the simplest idea that, you know, that is extremely powerful, but very simple idea. All you're saying is probability of A given B is defined as probability of A and B by probability of B. Okay? So probability of B given A is defined as probability of A and B by probability of A. These are definitions. Okay, and Reverend Bayes basically said, well, you know, if you put this PB here and you put this PA here, okay, then I essentially have PA and B can be written in two different ways. Okay, and so I can then use that to say PA given B is nothing but PB given A times PA by PB. Simple algebra. Okay, and the beauty of Bayes' rule is if you are trying to find most probabilities in the world are given in the causal direction, okay, and you are trying to figure out the diagnostic probabilities most of the time. You know, to put this in very concrete perspective, doctors essentially will know that if you have disease D, then you are likely to have this symptom with some probability. That's what their textbooks tell them. Okay, but very few people go to the doctor and say, I already have this disease, can you check whether I have this symptom? Do you see? I mean, how often have you gone to a doctor saying, I already have flu, can you check if I have runny nose? It never happens because it's a useless piece of information for you. So you're more likely to ask the other question. I have runny nose, can you tell me what's the probability that I have flu? Okay, so I can now, using Bayes' rule, compute the probability of flu given runny nose in terms of the probability of runny nose given flu, which is a causal direction probability that can be easily assessed, and a, you know, and then prior probability of flu and prior probability of runny nose. Okay, in particular, one more interesting issue is, so I can say probability of flu given runny nose is probability of runny nose given flu times probability of flu by probability of runny nose. Of these, this is causal direction probability. You know, flu giving, you know, flu, how often does flu cause runny nose? And this is just the prevalence of flu in this area. That too can be found. Okay, what might be harder is the prevalence of runny nose in this area. Okay, but suppose you went to the doctor and you already have runny nose and the doctor is trying to figure out, are you likely to be suffering from flu or Ebola virus? The nice thing is that that one also would be probability of Ebola, probability of runny nose given Ebola. Times probability of Ebola by probability of runny nose. So if all I want to know is which is higher, this is a normalizing factor. I can ignore it. Do you see what I'm saying? That's actually what we will do today too. Okay, so all they need to know is this causal probability, how often does Ebola actually cause runny nose, and this prior probability, how likely is Ebola disease in this area. This is what I'm going to do. So that's what I'm going to do here. So I wanted to compute CI given E, that's class probability distribution given the examples. That can be written as example given class probability distribution times class probability divided by example. Now in this case, who are the diseases, and if you want the disease and symptom scenario, what is disease and what is symptoms here? Example is what? Symptoms. Examples are the symptoms. And a class is the underlying disease. Okay? So, now basically, so I'm now looking for class causing the example. That's what I'm trying to find. In some sense, that's almost what this picture was also telling me. Okay? But before I get there, I actually had to make a big assumption to get to this picture. So in general, if I am looking for example, given class times class divided by example, and remember this part can eventually be forgotten because you're going to, for each of the classes, you're trying to find class equal to true, what's the probability, class equal to false, what's the probability. Both of them will have P of E as the denominator, and so they are the normalizing factor. So you just need to know the remaining number. If it's bigger for C1 than to C2, then C1 is the one which wins, right? Okay. So of these, PCI is actually easy to compute, okay? Because if in the restaurant example, basically a probability CI means how often do people wait for tables in the restaurant? How often do people just leave without waiting for tables in the restaurant? Well, that's not hard because if you go back to that big table I showed you, you can count how many times were people waiting and how many times were people not waiting. So number of times they're waiting divided by total number of times is the waiting probability. Number of times they're not waiting divided by total number of times is the not waiting probability. It's very easy to compute PCI. Okay, it's also easy to ignore P of E. That's what I've been talking to you about. So the only thing that's left for us is computing probability of E given CI, probability of example given the class information. Now why is that difficult? It turns out that I need this kind of probability. So it needs A1 is value 1 and A2 is value 2, etc., AK equal to value K, given CI is true, class is ith class. This is the probability I need. Okay, how many such probabilities do you need to learn? It's basically, if you think that there are D values for each attribute, and there are K attributes, then there are d power k numerators in the conditional probability and n different denominators for the n classes. So you need n times d power k probabilities. Remember, we were talking about learning compresses the data. You are expanding the data. Most of the time you will have 10 examples and you are trying to convert it into 10 million probabilities. Okay, and we'll see in a minute that the problem is all those probabilities can be computed, but most of them will be zero. And they'll be zero for totally bogus reasons. They're zero because that particular example wasn't in your training example. So you just assume it's a zero. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so the problem with this is actually the way you should do it, but it just requires way too many probabilities. So what do I need to do? What I need to do is I'm stuck with a joint probability here. Okay? Joint probabilities are bad. Joint probabilities are bad because to compute the joint probabilities, you need as many, a joint probability distribution over n Boolean variables will require 2 power n probabilities. I want to get by with fewer number of probabilities. Okay? How do I do that? Well, if somehow I can write the joint into a simpler form. Now, you do know that sometimes P, A, and B can be written as P, A times P, B. When can you write that? Independence. Okay, there is a better, you know, independence is just too strong a constraint, but there is a slightly different constraint called conditional independence, which says PAB given C is PA given C times PB given C. That's called conditional independence. So here is, this independence only holds when C is given. It doesn't hold all the time. Okay, now suppose I go ahead and assume this picture, the class is causing A1, A2, AN. And if I know the class, then the value of A1 taking being true is uniquely specified by just this probability. If I tell you the class is true, and I ask you, what's the probability that A1 is true? You will say some number. Now I say, well, I want to give you some more information. I just found out that A2 is false and AN is true. Would you like to change your mind? In this case, you won't change your mind, because this causal theory is explaining to you that class is independently causing each of the symptoms. It's not that the symptoms have no correlations between them that can't be explained by the correlation by the cause from the class. This is the assumption I will make. Okay? It's a less restrictive assumption than this. This is assuming everything is independent, but more restrictive than assuming no independence at all. Okay? So I will make this independence assumption, and so once I do this, all of a sudden, this becomes essentially probability of A1 equal to V1 given C times probability of A2 equal to V2 given C times probability of AK VK given C. So I have a big multiplication here. But it's not, the problem is not the multiplication. The problem is what you might look at this multiplication and, you know, lose heart, but you really should be very happy, because the total number of these probabilities now you have to learn is how many? It's just N times D times K. N times D times K. A little displacement of K from, you know, superscript to float changes everything. Do you see what I'm saying? You made this assumption. You made this assumption, and with this assumption, you can now make, you need to now learn much fewer probabilities. The question is, just because I now close my eyes, has the class become empty? I don't see anybody. Has it become empty? It makes me much happier if I close my eyes, then I don't have to see you. But does that help? It's just an assumption I'm making. Do you see what I'm saying? Some people actually, basically do all sorts of assumptions. How many of you see the King's Speech or something, where he will make his own assumptions that, you know, he's just talking to just one person, not these tens of thousands of people. Just because he's thinking that way doesn't mean the world has changed. It's made his life easy. Sometimes he actually would be in big trouble if he thinks really that he's only talking to one person and he takes it literally, then he might be telling bad things about some of the people in the 10,000 people, and those guys will get mad. Okay, assumptions are assumptions. You make them to make your life simple. So in this case, you made this huge assumption about independence between attributes, conditional independence between attributes given the class, which is pure bogus. But the reason I'm teaching you this in the class is, even in domains where attributes have correlations themselves, which is not explainable just from the class, naive-Bayes classifiers still seem to work fine. That's why we make this assumption. Okay, now many of us look for lines, you know, I mean, psychologists are always given some data, right? You always look for a line. Why are you looking for a line? Did I tell you there is a line? Really, what you should be looking for is, you know, something that's just as good as that line, because it too connects all the points. You're looking for lines because you assumed that there is a line behind. And if you assume that, you will find a line. Now, to the extent people talk about linear systems, it's because most of the time, uncannily, even though the world is nonlinear, linear assumptions still seem to get us through the day without getting hit by big trucks. Okay? The fact that we are still here essentially means that somehow enough things are linear that our assumptions seem to work out well with the way the world works, even though we can give 10 million pathological examples where there are no lines in the data. You'll still find lines, because you're looking for lines, you'll find them. And similarly, I can give you 10 million cases where words are correlated. Give me an example of if the features are words. So in the case of text documents, then essentially this is CIE spam, and these are the word data, okay, or the word computer. Okay, now can you give me an example which sort of makes me realize, makes all of you realize that actually words themselves can be correlated even without, even though you know the class information? Data, if you see data, you're more likely than not to see structure, irrespective of what class you are in. Okay? So the words themselves can have correlations. Data is already correlated with structure. Computer is likely to be correlated with programming. I'm ignoring all these inter-word correlations, and I'm assuming that the class randomly decides each word according to the probabilities of that word. So one of these is data, one of this is structure. So this guy might pick data and not pick structure. But you want to say that if you pick data, then your probability of picking structure should be higher. And this model doesn't capture that. You see what I'm saying? So many reasons why this shouldn't work, but it works. And in fact, there's a paper that, you know, there is a slide on that at the end. There's a paper which basically talks about why does naive-Bayes classification work in practice. And one reason, it turns out, is that using these assumptions, what are you trying to compute? You're trying to compute probability that the mail is spam given the example, then probability that mail is not spam given the example. Okay, suppose if you did everything right, if you did everything right and you didn't make any assumptions whatsoever, then the true golden standard probability of spam given your example mail is 0.75, and probability of not spam given example is 0.25. Naive-Bayes classifier would compute these as, let's say, probability of spam given example as 0.501. Probability of not spam given example as 0.499. What is the percentage error in the probability? Humongous. What is the error in classification? Zero. Do you understand what I'm saying? You know, sometimes you guys do this too. Essentially, I'm converting a continuous quantity into a threshold. So you want to hope that eventually Rav has to put an A line and a B line. So even if I ignore this homework and not do that project, probably he will feel, you know, riddled with guilt and, you know, push me up of the whatever line I want. Okay, so even though my marks are so much less than what I actually could have got, my grade would still be the same, hopefully, if, you know, God and teacher willing, right? And the same thing here. So essentially, it turns out that naive-Bayes classifiers will compute the probabilities highly erroneously. And yet, more often than not, what matters to us is not the exact probability, but whether the relative order is correct. And if the relative order is correct, then, and there are more cases where the probabilities are wrong and yet relative order is correct. So that's one reason why naive-Bayes actually seems to work. Yes?
The number of classes are more.
It reduces, this problem becomes harder as the number of classes increase. Yes. Okay. Then, so anyway, so basically I'm assuming in doing this, I have assumed this structure for Bayes network. In fact, you can understand this slide without knowing a word about Bayes networks. It's just that you will have a more deeper appreciation of what you did here. What you did here is you assumed that the underlying Bayes network is this. You gave the topology of the Bayes network and you said it's exactly this way, and given this, then all I need is the prior probability for the class and for each of the attribute, conditional probability of the attribute given the class. Those are the only numbers I need. But I could have drawn humongously different number of Bayes networks on the same set. So for example, here is one where C is causing X1, but X1 is also causing X2. So here is a situation where C causes data, and if data is there, then structure becomes more likely to be present. So now X2 depends on class being computer science and the word data is already present. So in which case, probability of having the word structure is slightly higher. If I do this, I need more probabilities to be computed. The problem now is x2 has two parents. X2 has C as a parent and x1 as a parent. And in Bayes networks, the rule is for every node in the network, you need the probability of that node given each possible configuration of its parent. And if you have one parent, you just have the parent's configuration. If you have n parents, you have exponential number of configurations where exponential in n. If you have five parents and they're all Boolean, then you consider 2^5 configurations for your parent. Okay? So that's how then you will start. If you want this, you will need to learn more numbers. It's not so much that you can't learn them, it is that the data may not support accurate estimation of all these numbers. Okay? So, continuing along, so I would then compute the probabilities that each attribute takes a value given the class, and I'll compute the prior probability of the class, and once I have that, I can actually decide which class, given a new test data point, what is the probability for it belonging to class 1 versus class 2 versus class 3, and whichever is the highest, I say that's the class. So do remember that naive Bayes classifier actually computes the posterior distribution on the class. Having computed this posterior distribution, 0.501, 0.499, it just picks the one that's the largest and forgets the rest. This is important because later on I'll tell you a trick we can do to remember this labeled versus unlabeled examples that I talked about. We'll get back to it next class and see that you can actually use the posterior distribution and then actually also use unlabeled examples. But we'll get to that later. Okay, so to compute these probabilities themselves, all I need to do is just count. Okay, for example, here is my, forget about all this. So here is my example that I'm going to do, from the restaurant scenario. And I am going to say, I will say that probability of will wait equal to yes is one of the probabilities I would need. Given this data, all I need to do is probability will wait equal to yes. There are a total of 12 examples, and the number of yes examples are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 6 by 12.5. That's what I'll do. Okay, and then the other kind of things I need is probability that pattern is equal to full given will weight equal to yes. So then I will only look at the 6 rows where will weight is equal to yes. There are only 6 of them. And see how many of them have patterns equal to full. Okay, and you will see that there are 2 of them which have patterns equal to full. So there is a full here, not here, and there is a full here. Which one? Yeah, there's a full there. 2 fulls, right? So 2 fulls divided by the 6 examples, which have will weight equal to yes, so which is 0.333 is the probability. Yes? No, remember, independence is attributes are independent of each other only given the class. I did not make the assumption that attributes are just completely independent. I'm not saying this, I'm saying this. This is an even more excessive assumption. So for example, again making a metaphor, we made assumptions, we make assumptions in our life all the time. In the very beginning of this class, we made the assumption that let's think of documents as bags of things. Okay? When you're thinking of it as bags of things, why not bags of letters? That was too ridiculous. Bags of words is pretty ridiculous, but it seems to be fine. People are not going on the street and going into revolution for bags of words, so we'll stick with it. Shingles, not enough people are complaining, we'll get by with bags of words. Okay, so bags of words is a less restrictive assumption than bags of words, and bags of letters. Okay, similarly, conditional independence is a much less restrictive assumption than full independence. If this holds, this holds. But this can hold without this being held. Okay? It's always better to get by with less number of assumptions. Again, the same reason. You could go with bag of letters example, That's a good assumption. It's just that the performance will be so bad that nobody would use your system. Okay. Okay, so then patterns equal to some given will weight equal to S, same way you can compute it as 4 by 6, which is 0.6. Now, given these numbers, then will weight equal to S, given patterns equal to full. So, suppose one of the nice things about naive-Bayes classifier actually is that it does not require that the example be completely defined. As soon as you know anything about the example, I can give you a new posterior. So, for example, I tell you, well, in the new case, I'm going along with this guy and they went to a restaurant where patterns are full. What do you think? Would he wait or not wait? I haven't yet figured out the rest. Already I can compute the new probability. And then if I get one more evidence, then I can recompute this. So posteriors keep improving in accuracy with respect to the evidence. They don't necessarily just change in a monotonic way. Okay? So in this case, will weight equal to S, given patterns equal to full. If patterns equal to full, given will weight equal to S, times will weight equal to S, divided by patterns equal to full. Okay? And these numbers we have. And I'll assume this 1 over this, I'll just assume is a constant K, because that's going to be used for other classes too. So for this class, it will be K times 0.333 times 0.5. And similarly, I can compute will weight equal to no given patterns equal to full, and that would be k times 0.66 times 0.5. Okay, at this point you can see that clearly this number is bigger than this number. So you would then say, well, the probability that he won't wait is higher than the probability that he will wait, given the evidence that patterns are full. And so I will say that the class for this example, only partially specified example, okay, is this. By the way, so in fact, the fact that you can get by with partially specified examples is a huge plus point for naive-Bayes classifier. Okay, suppose you're trying to figure out a hyperspace, hyperplane separating the data points. Now, if I don't give you one of the coordinates, you can't even plot the point. Do you understand what I'm saying? I have a three-dimensional point, okay, x, y, z, where x equal to 1, y equal to 2. Where is the point? There's no point. Basically, what you have is a line now. You see what I'm saying? So when you have missing data in the training data, missing attribute values in the training data, some learning algorithms are good at dealing with them, some are not. Naive-Bayes is actually quite good at dealing with them. So it can incrementally use the evidence. I can give you the coordinates one after the other, and I just keep improving my guess. It's kind of a nice thing. Okay? So that's Naive-Bayes classification. The actual doing of it is, mind-numbingly simplistic. Understanding how you got away from doing it is interesting. Ultimately, it's just a bunch of multiplications and divisions. Right? But what the reason you got here is you essentially made some critical assumptions, which don't make sense really, but you get by. Okay? One interesting question is the training data size is small. And the problem in general, remember one of the things I said is, if you really were going to look for probabilities of this kind, you could have computed this kind too. It's just that in the 10 examples, if there are, let's say, 12 attributes, so that means there are at least 2 power 12 different example configurations if all attributes are Boolean. If they are all up to 4 possible values, then it's your 4 power 12. The probability that any random example from the 4 power 12 examples is actually present in one of the 12 examples you took as a training data is, vanishingly low. So you will get a whole bunch of zeros. Do you see that? Okay, now, this will reduce when you start realizing, looking for probabilities on just single attribute values. But it doesn't go away. Okay. For example, it may well be that certain attribute values are so rare that in the 12 examples, you did not get that certain that attribute value in any of the examples. If you did not, then when you count, what's the probability that, let's say, so what's the probability that that attribute will have that value given the class is will wait, you will compute that as in terms of count as a big zero. Because the numerator would be zero, denominator would be the number of examples, so you'll get a zero. What's wrong with a zero? Zero is forever. When you're multiplying in particular, zero is forever. Okay, you can have a huge number of little probabilities. Everything is fine except this one zero sitting there happily. And if that zero gets, remember, in this case, there's a simple multiplication. In many cases, there'll be a large number of multiplications, each possible attribute value given the class. If any one of them is zero, the entire probability becomes zero. So essentially, you lost it now. You have no power to predict anymore. Okay, so you have this zero problem. Okay, now how do I deal with this zero problem? So here is a thing to think about. Suppose I just tossed a coin twice and it came up heads both times. Can I assume that the probability of tails is equal to zero? Or if I tossed a coin thrice, it came heads twice and tails once. Can I assume that the probability of getting heads is 2/3 and tails is 1/3? No. Suppose I toss this coin 3 billion times. I have no work to do today. I'm going to toss this coin 3 billion times. Okay. And it came heads 2 billion times and came tails 1 billion times. Should I still assume that this is a fair coin? It's just having a bad day. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. You should not. As the number of examples increases, you believe the training data. When the number of examples is small, you distrust the training data a little bit more. Right? Okay? So you need a way of smoothing these probability estimates so that when the data is small, the smoothed estimate will make sure that you won't get zeros. I mean, from a math point of view, you to make sure that you won't get zeros. From a semantic point of view, it stops you from saying just because this poor coin came twice heads and one tail in three experiments, you shouldn't assume that it's 2/3 probability of coming heads and 1/3 probability of coming tails. But at the same time, if you did it 3 billion times and it came 2 billion times heads and 1 billion times tails, you should assume that it is an unfair coin with 2/3 probability of coming heads and 1/3 probability of coming tails. How do I do this? What I would do then is I will assume, in a sense, what you're doing, actually, the reason you did not. So how about this? I said coin. Okay. So instead, I will say there are some three random examples about some learning scenario. Okay. And first two examples are positive examples. The third example is a negative example. Should I or should I not assume that the positive example probability is 2/3? You no longer know. You don't know. The reason you did not want me to do 2/3 heads and 1/3 tails for the coin is because you have prior knowledge about coin tossing. You assume that unless told otherwise, you want to believe that the coins are fair. And you should be pulled, screaming and kicking, to be made to believe that the coin is not fair. So one way of thinking about it is, even though you have the training data, you also assume that you have a whole bunch of virtual examples. So you're sort of believing that, you know, Rav is tossing coin three times, but before he even started tossing these three coins, I've already tossed coins 100 times before. In those 100 times, I got heads 50 times, tails 50 times. So I have 100 virtual examples that I only know, Rao doesn't know. Plus then Rao has 3 more examples. In my 100 virtual examples, 50 came heads. In Rao's 3 examples, 2 came heads. So my count now would be 52 by 103. This will make sure that you will get, in this case, it's close to half. Whereas if Rao has no work and does 3 billion here and this is 2 billion, then it will be 2 billion 50 by 3 billion 100, which will still be 2/3. This is what we will do. We will essentially assume the smoothing that we will use, what we'll assume is there are m virtual examples, and you need to assume, you know, you have 100 virtual examples, you need to assume how many of them will come heads. Okay, I will just assume that uniform probability, if it can come either heads or tails, then I'll assume it will come uniform probability heads or tails. Okay, so then I will say I have, apart from the number of examples that Rao has and number of those examples which have the attribute having a specific value, I also made up m virtual examples of which m times p of them are actually also having a equal to vi. Now this p would depend on, if the attribute has 15 possible values, p would be 1 over 15. That's like assuming all values are equally plausible. Okay, if I do this, then essentially I will make sure that I am not blindly believing in the data. When the data is small, my prior should make a difference. But when the data becomes bigger and bigger, if you still continue to say, so in the beginning you may have your own prior and you assume that, you know, this must be noise. But after 3 billion you still want to stick to your prior, then you are being irrational. And this idea of what's called Laplacian smoothing, which basically allows virtual samples which are added both to the denominator and the numerator, will take care of it. So that's what you wind up doing in NBC. So that, in fact, it's done for all probabilities, just not, this way you'll make sure you'll never get any zeros. But more importantly, all probabilities are going to be different now, because they're not just 2 by 3, it's 2 plus 50 by 3 plus 100. Okay? And as the number of training examples keeps increasing, the effect of this prior slowly wears away. And for the small number of training examples, the prior will basically make sure that you don't rashly jump to conclusions just because you saw a couple of examples. If you do that in computing your probabilities, then naive-Bayes classifier works very well. Okay, I'll stop here. Next class, we'll complete this discussion and go into recommendation systems.